Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
A little change of subject will be no harm to us at all. I'll take a breather for a second because I want to talk about sports washing, which is a very important topic. It's become a kind of part of our vocabulary in recent years. It's particularly relevant to the world of football because this whole sort of distraction from ethical issues in football, as sports washing is kind of shorthand for, took over from the hosting of the 2022 World Cup in Qatar to various regimes owning some of the biggest football clubs in the world, including in England. So to tell me about it, I'm joined from London by Miguel Delaney, chief football writer at the London Independent, and he's the author of States of Play, How Sports Washing Took Over Football. Good morning, Miguel.
Good morning.
Sports washing is a heavy term used an awful lot. People sometimes forget to define it. Can you explain to us what your breakdown of it is?
I try to kind of boil down the description to this, which is essentially the political use of sport, mostly by autocratic regimes or autocratic states with access to, I suppose, more money or a greater concentration of money that has ever been seen in history, which is a key part of this, for the purpose of normalization of these states. And obviously that can take a lot of form. So even if you, it's interesting now, and I suppose in the context of, say, Newcastle United, and there's actually been some discussion over how much public investment fund, who are essentially the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, given it's their sovereign state, their sovereign wealth fund.
Yeah.
There's been some talk about their ambitions for the club. But the way it was actually even put to me 2 weeks ago was, well, no matter what next with Saudi Arabia's purchase of Newcastle, even if they don't become like Manchester City, say, it's worked to a certain degree because, I mean, put bluntly, how many people talk about Jamal Khashoggi anymore? It managed to basically erode headlines. And it's the same kind of force you see now with LIV Golf, with the boxing. Now, I only cover football, but just to give an example of how it's working, it just takes the space of where there would be critical discussion. And even, as I put it in the book, one way it works, say, even on very simple terms, if you Google, say, Saudi Arabia, you no longer really see headlines about Khashoggi or a lot of human rights issues or capital punishment. You see a lot of football, basically. You know, Cristiano Ronaldo there, and that's, I suppose, how it works in very rudimentary terms. And the book opens, I suppose, with almost as basic an illustration of sports washing as you can get, and the kind of dynamics behind it, which was, you know, when December 2022, I was there in Lusail Stadium as Leo Messi completes, I suppose, what would be considered one of the greatest narratives in sport.
For
similar,
sure.
Say, to Muhammad Ali Muhammad Ali winning the heavyweight title again in the 70s. It's Messi finally completing this quest towards the end of his career of lifting the World Cup. Hmm. And what happens at that moment? Well, the Emir of Qatar places a bisht on him. And while the bisht in any other context would be entirely innocent, it's an honourable garment. This would usually be a beautiful cultural gesture. You can't separate it from who has given it to him, which is the most powerful person in one of the most powerful autocracies in the world now, given Qatar's influence, especially at that moment. So for the first time in history, the lifting of the World Cup features something other than a team, the winning team's own kit, their own colours. And I suppose what that does really, in very direct terms as well, is that means in the same way the Azteca Stadium in Mexico is always associated with Maradona, with Pelé, well, Lusail and Doha and Qatar are always associated with this brilliant football story.
Greatest ever World Cup final. Yes, they totally own that.
As Nick McGeehan, who has done a lot of work in this for Fair Square, human rights activist, as he put it, like in 80 years' time, a little bit like with the 78 World Cup in Argentina, people won't be talking about the issues. They'll be talking about Leo Messi and this great story.
That's right. And it was perfectly normal at that stage to have a World Cup final a week before Christmas in 2022 because we'd been so used to the stories about Qatar. But by the time it happened, it was, of course, sports washed. Remind us how Qatar got that World Cup.
It was the joint winning of Russia 2018 and Qatar 2022. And while there's obviously been a lot of focus on, I suppose, you know, some the corruption claims that ultimately did bring overhaul of FIFA in 2015.
Yeah,
those World Cups weren't won with the kind of the classic images of payments to voters or this sort of thing. although that was part of the story, as the FBI have uncovered. I mean, Qatar struck fossil fuel deals with Thailand, where, of course, one of the key voters for that World Cup was. Russia did similar. England had been going for 2018 and had been considered the favourites. And it's funny, like, I have a line I've got in the book where, obviously, that World Cup was lost to Russia.
Yeah.
And after the fact, I mean, England had received scrutiny for handing out these kind of expensive handbags to try and win votes. And as someone put it to me in the book, I mean, it was almost laughable how naive the English bid was. You're handing out handbags while, you know, Putin is getting involved at a much higher level. That's how those World Cups are won now. So yeah, and it was USA that obviously wanted 2022. I've got a story in the book about how on that day, Bill Clinton had been absolutely furious. He was involved in America's bid.
Yeah.
Barack Obama rang Sepp Blatter the night before, but as indicated by Blatter's discussion with Obama that night, a lot of people in FIFA feared how it was going to go, which was basically that, it was going to be Russia and Qatar 2018-22, something that would have been unthinkable even a few months beforehand. Then, of course, USA made a huge push for 2026. And what you kind of see is what's really happened is horse trading between major states for a competition that's almost become too big to be held in all but a few countries. But if you say, take that how USA didn't win 2022, well, one of the corollaries of that was that it attuned an existing FBI investigation into corruption in football. Now, what happens there? 5 years later, there's eventually a huge overhaul of FIFA, and we're continuing to feel the ripples of that. But while there'd been a lot of focus on FIFA, there was also a spillover into UEFA, the European body, who are essentially an equivalent body to FIFA, but under FIFA's jurisdiction. And just to add another flavour to the story, they're currently essentially at war with FIFA.
Yes. Okay.
But there was a vacuum of power in UEFA. And what happened at that point? Well, the major clubs, who were all primarily owned by American capitalist ownership or states, they essentially made a land grab to try and claim more of the Champions League money for themselves. And that, and the effect on the game, and how suddenly they were playing, all these clubs were playing in the Champions League against clubs that are far, far wealthier then. Well, what did that inevitably lead to? The Super League. Yes. And huge ructions. And it's amazing how when you start to stand back and look at all of this over kind of
the ramifications are enormous, periods. Aren't they? And you have a lovely detail on Qatar winning that World Cup all those years ago. You see one story, but it almost distracts from all the other ones, the deep involvement of all these tyrannical states, really, in football to this day, have almost gone unnoticed until you put it all together like you have in this book.
And that's exactly it. And for all we're focusing on the Super League there, and the Super League was very American influenced. And around that time as well, there had been plans to bring, say, the Champions League final to New York, to America, because this is the market they all want. That's where the money in football is now. Yeah. And it's for, like, ultimately, one of the main conclusions of the book, one of the main driving dynamics is how football has been distorted by three main forces. One is geopolitics, primarily from autocracies in the Gulf, but not exclusively. One is a very Western form of capitalism who, unlike the Gulf autocracies, want to extract money out of the sport, really just to use it for profit, not necessarily for the good of sport. And thirdly, the failure of football's regulators to actually deal with this in any way.
In terms of the English Premier Division now, are there still question marks? Is it being investigated in any way? You know, Newcastle have been taken over only, 3 years ago by Saudi Arabia, and the investigation is still ongoing into Manchester City.
Well, I mean, the City hearing really is a classic illustration of all of these. It's almost a distillation of all of this, as well as a potential existential event, at least for football in the Premier League as we know it. Like, I've got an instructive story in the book from what many people see as a key moment in this entire history, which was when Roman Abramovich took over Chelsea in 2003.
Yeah.
Now, prior to that, almost every owner in the Premier League, say, had been British or British-based. It was a very parochial league still, and this is 11 years after its founding.
Yeah.
And Abramovich doesn't just put it into under a sphere of wealth. He puts it onto a different sphere of owner, given that he's someone basically, unlike a lot of these owners like Jack Walker or Blackburn, no one can get near him. No one knows what he's thinking. But despite that, and despite all these stories, even then, of connections to Putin, how did the Premier League respond to that? There wasn't even a special meeting to discuss this potential owner.
They
very
do
few
nothing.
People spoke
the
out
sum
at
total
all.
Of nothing.
Was, yeah.
Yeah. I'm listening to the passion and a tinge with anger from yourself, Miguel Delaney. I mean, you're the chief football writer for the London Independent. Having researched all of this, I mean, looking at it in the round, as you have done, has it changed your perspective, your look at football?
The book probably evolved out of years I've been writing about this and an attempt to make sense of all these kind of, where suddenly I'm in a world where not only am I not just writing about what happens on the pitch anymore, but it feels like what happens on the pitch is less consequential, because it's almost as if so many of these wider forces actually dictate what happens on the pitch now. And you can see it now, basically what, like Manchester City have just subjected the Premier League to the most intense period of domination they've ever seen. Sure, it's not as long as Alex Ferguson's yet, but they've won more points and also extended kind of the record from three leagues in a row to four, made it 6 and 7 for the first time in history. Yeah. Similar with Paris Saint-Germain in France. And you can, I suppose, before your eyes,
it's upset
really
the balance, hasn't it?
The sport distorted, yeah, completely. Yeah.
There's good entertainment here as well. You also talk about our own league here in Ireland, which has concluded with one of the best finishes for quite some time. But you cover the history, don't you, of how, you know, we don't support it in the numbers that we should because of television.
Well, I think there's a very interesting dynamic there, because, I mean, like, again, I suppose this points to how the book goes into all sorts of other areas. I mean, football, it's current. Where it currently is really came from the 80s. Rather than create a situation where lots of teams can compete through having similar finance and be able to pay the same wages, it creates a system of concentration. Mm-hmm. One of the phrases used in the book was that by Silvio Berlusconi, the former owner of Milan, who of course became the Prime Minister of Italy, which is the virtuous cycle. Basically, you invest in the team. And the team becomes more commercially attractive. The team becomes more commercially attractive, and then you buy better players, and on until. And basically, this is the dynamic we've seen in football, to the point that only about 12 clubs are of that kind of international size, because really, the rest of the world are only interested in these clubs. And that was a dynamic actually first seen in Ireland. We were actually almost kind of a petri dish for this, although no one intended it. Because mm-hmm. what happened in Ireland, basically in the 60s. The League of Ireland used to have very healthy crowds, Shamrock Rovers in particular. But end of the 60s, Match of the Day comes on BBC. It's broadcast in Ireland. And from that, it can be tracked. Attendance is limited because people are exposed to a higher level of football. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we've seen rising attendances in the League of Ireland in the last few years. So potentially, it's coming full circle.
The book is called States of Play, How Sports Washing Took Over Football. It's a fascinating read. There's a bit of fun in there as well. And I mean, it is an endlessly interesting thing. But fair play to you for highlighting the aspect which is sometimes ignored.
Cheers. Thanks, Oliver.
Miguel Delaney, thanks a million. We'll talk to you again.